Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me again one of my favorite authors, and hopefully yours too, Mr. John Gaspard. Hey there, John.
Hello, Scott. How are you?
Fine, thank you. All of a sudden, you got this voice. Hello, Scott. How are you?
This is my podcast voice. This is the sound of my voice.
You sounded so good just a moment ago there, and all of a sudden, it's kind of like, you know, you've gone into this ventriloquist voice or something there.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, so good to talk with you, and we last chatted, I was just checking before I got online here. It was in January of this year, and here we are. The year hasn't even completed, and we are about to release the second in the Eli Marks detective mystery novel.
Yes,
series.
The Bullet Catch is the new one.
I am very excited about that. And tell me how, first of all, that the sales have been going with the first one. Obviously good enough, I guess, to warrant a second one and keep the series going. Make it actually a series. When you have two, it becomes a series, I guess.
It does, yes. It's now officially a series, and it's on its way to three. Sales are quite good, and they are exactly what I predicted percentage-wise, because the publisher had said, well, I'm sure magicians are going to buy this book. And I said, you know, no. I think any magician who likes mysteries would want to buy this book. But other than that, just because you're a magician doesn't mean you buy every book on magic. And so I was proven correct on that. And a good number of magicians have bought the last one and have gotten some very nice notes about, particularly from people who aren't magicians saying, are you sure you're not a magician? You sure seem to know a lot. And as I explained to them, I only know more than they do. I don't know as much as a magician does. I just know more than the average layperson.
Yeah.
But magicians are praising the accuracy, which was my big goal, was I wanted to present magic accurately without giving anything away.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, certainly, that you have decided to write something that you – well, most times they say that authors – the most successful ones are those that know something about what they're writing about. However, when it's going to be particularly fiction, let's say science fiction about the future, or let's say Stephen King is writing, you know, something that's completely bizarre, those are things that are not of the real world always necessarily. So it might be difficult to actually follow that old adage of writing what you know about. But in this case, you were not a magician, but why was it you decided to write about magic and magicians?
Because I had done a book about Jack the Ripper, and I enjoyed the process of writing a novel. I've written and produced a lot of low-budget independent movies, which is in itself fun and interesting, but requires a lot of people and a lot of time and some money, but not that much. But a novel is something that I wouldn't have to really engage anybody else in. I could just, when I had spare time, I would do that. And I thought I'd like to write a series, and I started thinking about what would be a good protagonist. And as it turns out, I have a lot of friends who are magicians. I have more friends who are magicians than the average person who isn't a magician. I think the average person, if they have one friend who's a magician, would be a little odd. I've got like a half dozen.
And that's quite true. You know, certainly for those who are non-magicians, to have, first of all, to meet a magician is rather strange and kind of odd because there are so few of us, but then also to count them among friends that you can chat with and have them, you know, in your phone directory or something.
Right.
Seems like they're even fewer. And for you to not be a magician, I mean, you're not one who attends conventions, belongs to local magic club and hangs out and does card tricks late at night with everybody. That's really not your thing, but you enjoy all of the accoutrement, I guess, surrounding the magic.
And there is I think percentage-wise, particularly at conventions, there is a small percentage of us who go, because I've gone to a couple conventions and enjoyed them tremendously, but there's a small percentage of us who do not do magic or create magic or are magicians, but who enjoy the history of magic and the process of magic. And that's what I found I enjoyed, and I thought I could, with a little bit of work, write a credible character, and because he's a magician, there'd be some fun in if he gets involved in crimes, how would he use his special skills to get him in or out of that? And so I just landed on that. I like the dynamic of a young magician and an older magician. So I created his uncle. So it's Eli and his uncle Harry. Mm-hmm. And I put them in a magic shop because I thought that'd be a good base. And from there, it's just a question of, you know, making up the mystery that ties it in.
I'm just surprised, I guess, that it's taken so long for an author to put a magician in the place where he should be, specifically as one who solves mysteries, because Sherlock Holmes really could have been a great magician. And magicians tend to like Sherlock Holmes because, I believe, of his deductive reasoning and the way that he puts things together and thinks differently and creatively the way that magicians do. And so most times it seems that magicians are always the kind of the heavy in a book or in a movie or some sort of a nutso case, you know, that's just trying to kill somebody or right. It's always a magician who – it's either the butler or the magician who killed him, you know. But in this particular case, I think it's interesting that you picked up where other people seem to have missed that great opportunity to cast a magician in a fictional role here as a detective.
Well, I'm certainly not the first to do it. In fact, I'm blanking on the name now because I'm getting into that point in my life where I don't remember anything anymore. But there was a series of novels, I think in the 20s and 30s, that had a magician, a stage magician as the hero. So it has been done before, and obviously it's been done on TV, with The Magician, as an example. So it's been done, but what I was looking for was something contemporary, and what I was really looking for was something that was honest about the magic, where it was presented, so that you as a reader, if you're a magician, for example, there's, in the Bullet Cats, there's a scene where, my hero, Eli, does a quick invisible deck routine. And I'm very proud of the fact that if you're a magician, you will know that the questions he asks before he opens the box. He does what he needs to do before he, you know, as to which way you're going to turn the box when you mm-hmm. open it, which the reader would not catch. As a reader, just a layperson, they would have no idea that something was happening there. But as a magician, you'd go, oh, yeah, that's exactly how you do that. And that's what I wanted, was a magician to go, yep, that's how it's done.
You know, you're right. There have been some others. You know, Jim Swain has written some books with a magician being a central character. And it seems like Walter Gibson had written some. Of course, he'd written The Shadow, but in the radio play from way back when. And the television show, I also recall, was Black's Magic with Hal Linden. In that case, he was a retired magician, and then his father was a con man who was older than he was. So it was kind of a dynamic, a little bit like what is in your book.
You know, I looked at Black's Magic, and I looked at the magician, and they both cheat with the magic. I mean, they have stuff happens that could not, that is magical, but a real magician could not do. Mm-hmm. And that just drove me crazy. It really needed to be accurate.
In that regard, we had discussed this again in January, and I would encourage people to go back and listen to our first in-depth interview really talking all about that. But just kind of to recap there again, you had said that you kind of held to your belief rather than the magician becoming like Harry Potter and all of a sudden saying, yes, he does have these powers, that you wanted to stay true to the fact that he was just using sleight of hand and his wit and cleverness.
And whatever he happens to have on him.
Yeah, kind of like MacGyver.
A little like MacGyver, but a magician. Mm-hmm. And I might have mentioned this last time, but in the first book, The Ambitious Card, he ends up in a situation toward the end of the book, the climax of the book, where he does, in fact, save himself and the person he's with because of the stuff he has on him. And I went through a lot of agents trying to get that book sold. I mean, they sent it to a lot of publishers, lots of people turned it down, which is, I guess, kind of typical sometimes. And one of the comments I got back from one of the readers at the publishing house that it had gone to was they were very disappointed that he didn't use his magic in the last scene mm-hmm. to save himself when in fact he did use every magical tool he had at his disposal, but he didn't do anything like Harry Potter magical, which is somehow they thought that was what magicians do, and it just annoyed me that you think that.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about the new book, The Bullet Catch, and this has been something that I assume has kind of been in your mind for a while. And when you write one book, do you have another one in mind? You say, wait, I'm going to hold that for the next one. Or do you just kind of release everything and put it down on the word processor and then come back to it? And what is your thinking?
Well, that's interesting. In the case of The Bullet Catch, I'd read, I believe it's called 12 Had Died, mm-hmm. which is the history of The Bullet Catch, which is very interesting. And it seemed like, something I'd like to tackle with the second book. But I came up with sort of two mysteries, and I thought, well, I could save one for a third book, but they sort of work well together. And so the book gets just two sort of parallel stories going on. In one, Eli is helping a high school friend of his who's now an actor, and the actor is doing a movie that's being shot locally in which he's playing a magician who died while performing the bullet catch. And he, this actor, being a little on the neurotic side, is terrified because they've scheduled the bullet catch scene for the very last scene that they, in fact, plan to kill him and use that as terrific publicity to sell this otherwise low-budget movie. And so he engages Eli to come on as a magic consultant and basically make sure that he doesn't die during this, what he feels is a very dangerous trick. And at the same time, he also connects with an old high school flame whose husband is shot in a mugging, in a bullet catch of another kind. And so he's dealing with those two stories in parallel fashion as we move through the book. And I liked the idea that the bullet catch was literally the bullet catch in one story and figuratively a bullet catch in the second one. Mm-hmm. I hadn't planned on ever doing the bullet catch because my original plan with doing the ambitious card was that every book would be a trick that I could learn and do. And I did learn to do a decent ambitious card and thought, well, you know, the next one will be Twisted Aces or Cards Across or something. You know, I'll come up with something else. Mm-hmm. And then when it turned out to be the bullet catch, I went, well, I guess I'm not going to learn how to do that because that's just too dangerous.
Yeah. Speaking of which, that did you do a lot of research into that? Try to find out. I know there are a few methods, and Banachek's method is perhaps the most secretive method in the world,
and maybe the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having seen Penn and Teller do that a couple times, it's amazing. And I did do a good deal of research on everything that's written about it, people who've died. And I know Steve Cohen did it last year mm-hmm. on TV and got hurt while doing it, which I thought was a really interesting choice on his yeah. part to do it that way. And again, tried to be as accurate as possible. When the bullet catch happens in the book, Eli has devised a method to make it as safe as possible. And then things, kind of get pulled out of his control for a second. And so he, like we, the audience, in trying to follow the process of the bullet to the gun to the signing to all that, it does get a little muddled. And there is a moment of fear as did he do it wrong? But his method is unknown to me. I let him make up his own method. Normally, I would absolutely know how he did it. In just about any instance, I know exactly how he's doing something. Mm-hmm. In that case, I thought, I'm just going to let him make up his own, and I can't figure out how to do it, and it doesn't really, I think the way he does it would work. I'm just not going to go any further than saying I think it would work.
Well, that's true, because that's not something that you do with the book. You don't divulge how the secrets are done, like how the ambitious right. card routine is done, or double lifts, or anything like that.
No, I try to keep it as interesting and as readable as possible without betraying anything, but again, making it so the magician would go, yeah, that's plausible, that's reasonable, that could happen.
Right. Again, as far as the ideas that you have, once you're finished with a book, then do you immediately start working on another one, or you have one kind of always in mind, or do you have a file full of ideas that you want to kind of pick up and flesh out?
I keep a running list of titles that I find interesting, because magic is just full of really, really fun titles. I'm well into the third book now, and had done a lot of research on it. It was going to be called The Trick That Cannot Be Explained, mm-hmm. which is and Eric Mead's done some great writing on it, and Berger did, yeah, and it's really, really interesting. And I ran that by the publisher, and this is the day and age we're in. She said, that title's too long. I can't tweet that title. Hmm. Although I thought it was a great title. So as luck would have it, the mystery depended on a trick that Eli couldn't figure out. And so, in the third book, which is now called The Miser's Dream, there's a version that a magician does of The Miser's Dream, which is actually Levant's version of it, that, Eli doesn't know and can't figure out. So that's what's bothering him in that one, along with a bunch of other stuff that's going on.
And so the title of that book is going to be what?
The Miser's Dream.
The Miser's Dream. Okay. That's going to be book number 3.
That'll be number 3.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Whenever that you are starting to put out these books and in order to promote it, I assume that you were on some sort of a book tour, signing tour, or what was the launch like and how did you get these out into the public?
Yeah, it's a brave new world. they don't, for smaller books like this, they don't do an actual live tour anymore. They do what's called a blog tour. And so you end up doing, being a guest on, you know, 20 different blogs around the time that your book is being released and doing podcasts and interviews like this. And then introducing it via, there's a site called Goodreads that people who enjoy books go to Goodreads. You do giveaways and you do question and answer things there. In last year for the Ambitious Card and this year for the Bullet Catch, we'll be doing, a live signing at a local bookstore. That's just a one-night thing where a magician friend comes in and performs for the crowd, and I sign some books, and everybody has a good time. That's about as official as it gets. Everything else is done online now. It's sort of weird.
That is kind of strange. You know, of course, it used to be that people would go on a book tour of some sort, and that's back when they had bookstores and not just the mega stores. I think Borders has kind of gone out of business, but, you know, Barnes and Nobles and all that, but there used to be a lot of mom and pop type bookstores, and you can go on the road and travel. And when you're going then and talking with people on blogs, are you just kind of answering questions and you just go back and check the blog throughout the day or each night? Or is it, I mean, for a 24-hour period, kind of like a Reddit thing?
It really varies. Some, they send me an interview, set of questions ahead of time that I answer, and then comments pop up and you refer to those. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll want something written specifically for it. There's one blog that asks you to write a short piece, sort of the day in the life of your character. So you end up writing, not even a short story, but a little something that is unique to that blog. Other than that, there are giveaways on blogs, and then there's like the write a question and answer thing, which is always interesting.
Now, the book also, The Ambitious Card, was available and is available in electronic form, of course, on Kindle through Amazon and all that as well. And I assume, obviously, that The Bullet Catch will be also available electronically?
It will. It's paperback, any form of ebook you want. And the new thing they've started doing at the publishing house, which is really fun, is they're now doing hardcovers because they have found that while a large percentage of people like the ebook, there's a certain percentage, libraries in particular, that don't want paperbacks. They would prefer to have to start with a hardcover book that they can put a plastic cover on, and they get longer life out of it.
Right, right.
So it's now a hardcover, paperback, and ebook.
Okay. Well, if you don't mind right now, I think that I will just slip in here a reading of chapter 1 from The Bullet Catch, if that's okay with you.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, let's hear a reading from my favorite reader on The Bullet Catch, Chapter 1 by John Gaspard. The Bullet Catch, an Eli Marks mystery by John Gaspard. Chapter 1. Is this a new fear? I thought about this for a long moment. Well, I finally said, it's new to me. That's what I meant. Can you name it? What do you mean, like Pete or Louise? This elicited a deeply felt and well-earned sigh. I sense, not for the first time, that Dr. Backe was regretting taking me on as a new patient, at least this new patient. However, he was young and his office appeared to be new, and the rent payment had to come from somewhere. And so he had, probably, he was thinking now against his better judgment, said yes, and here I was.
Is the fear specific?
Yes.
When does it manifest?
Well, I said, searching for a word to describe it, I feel it mostly when I'm walking across a bridge or standing near the edge of the roof of a tall building, or on a balcony overlooking a high atrium, I added.
Ah, he said at long last, taking a note on his unsullied notepad, acrophobia.
I shook my head. No, I've always had acrophobia. I mean, not in a debilitating way. I know what that's like. This is different. He stopped in mid-stroke.
How so?
I didn't answer immediately, as I had never said this out loud before. I get this feeling, I said finally, when I'm on a bridge or high ledge,
and there's really nothing stopping me, and I should just go ahead and jump. Dr. Backe leaned back in his very new, slightly squeaky leather chair. There was the slimmest trace of a smile at the corners of his mouth.
"Is that the first time you've said that out loud?" he asked.
I took a deep breath. "Yes," I said.
"I knew it,"
he nearly cried out, coming just short of pumping his fist in the air. He sat back in the chair, clearly satisfied with this newly acquired diagnostic achievement. He made a few notes on the pad. It was the happiest I'd seen him all hour.
"You'll be relieved to know," he finally said as he finished his notes, "that what you're experiencing is not really all that rare, and is certainly treatable."
"Great. What is it?"
"Well," he said, nodding as sagely as a 20-something therapist can, "there's no clinical name for it, although some call it the imp of the perverse. It's when your mind suggests that you should do something that really isn't in your best interest."
"Like a voice in your head?" I asked.
"Perhaps. Or just a sudden or overpowering feeling that you should do something wrong. It manifests itself in many different ways. In your case, it's most likely an outgrowth of acrophobia. Many experts think it might simply be a reaction to stress."
He flipped the page in his notebook, smoothing out the new page before looking up at me.
"So what's going on in your life, Eli? What might be causing you stress?"
"Okay, let's see," I said as I sorted through where to begin in the rich tapestry which is my life. "I'm a magician, making my living doing corporate events, parties, restaurant work, that sort of thing."
"How's business?"
I shrugged. "Not too bad. It comes and goes." I struggled to generate more information that might be construed as relevant. "So, let's see. I'm 34. I got divorced almost 2 years ago. Turns out my wife was having an affair with a coworker."
"Sadly, not so uncommon," Dr. Backe commented quietly as he scribbled.
"So, I've learned. She's an assistant DA. He's a homicide cop. So you can imagine the romantic possibilities of that unholy union." Dr. Backe shot me a glance over his glasses, the look that suggested I should stick to the facts. "Anyway, so we got divorced. I had nowhere to live, so I moved back in with my Uncle Harry. My Aunt Alice had recently died, and they had mostly raised me, so I moved back into the old apartment above the Magic Store, over on Chicago and 48th Street. Chicago Magic." I sensed this was more detail than he really wanted.
"And what's that been like?"
he said, without looking up. "Not too bad, actually. Harry, that's my uncle, we've always gotten along really well. He's a magician, too. Very old school. He was on Ed Sullivan, that sort of thing. Basically taught me everything I know, but, as he likes to point out, not everything he knows. And I've always loved the store. You know, it's home." I paused, not sure what else he needed. He finished his note-taking and looked up.
"Anything else going on recently? Anything that might have caused you undue stress?"
Let's see," I sighed. "Well, I was recently suspected of killing a bunch of people, sort of a serial killer thing. Maybe you read about it. It was in all the papers. 3 psychics were killed. I know what you were going to say. If they were psychics, why didn't they see it coming? Trust me, they don't find that funny. Plus, my ex-wife's new husband was assigned to the case, so that was a hoot and a half. Anyway, during the course of the whole thing, I got conked on the head and also fell down a steep incline and got cut up pretty badly. Of course, I wasn't the killer, but I gotta tell you, it looked bad there for a while. The upshot was that I got a new girlfriend out of it, Megan. We were almost killed together, which sort of speeds up the bonding process. But then she felt we were moving too fast, and we're sort of taking a break right now." I added air quotes and immediately wished I hadn't. I looked over at Dr. Backe. He had ceased taking notes, although I wasn't entirely certain at what point he had stopped. He turned in his chair, set his notebook down, and picked up what looked to be an old-style day planner.
"That's great, Eli," he said slowly as he paged through the planner. "Just great. I think we're going to need to see you 2 or 3 times a week, at least to start. What are you doing the day after tomorrow?"
All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that little reading from Chapter 1. It also kind of gives you a good snapshot of what the rest of the book is going to be like. And I kind of selected that Chapter 1 because it also told you a little bit about what Eli Marks had done in the first novel and kind of get you caught up to date.
Yeah, I hope it's not too clunky. The problem with writing a series is you can't tell when they're going to come into the series. And there's certain things I can't say in the second book, because that would give away things that happened in the first book, but there's other things you have to say. And the use of the therapist, he will appear again and again in the book, was, I thought, sort of fun, because Eli has this new problem that he had a little tiny bit in the first book, which is a fear of heights. And in the second book, it's blown up into full-blown panic attacks anywhere he's near an open ledge of any kind, I mean, to the point of sweating and can't breathe and near collapse. And so I thought I would get that out of the way right away at the beginning of the book, because it's always more interesting to have a character who has a problem.
Right.
It seemed like a fun, well, fun might not be the right word, but an interesting problem for him to have to deal with along with everything else.
Yeah, it's an important thing. I think you need to get your main character up in the tree so that way you create some sort of tension.
Yep.
Yeah. And by the way, as I was... reading that, I must have been channeling Mr. Burns from The Simpsons as the therapist. It wasn't intentional, but I, as I was listening to that, I thought, it sounds kind of familiar. So, anyhow, as far as whenever that you've gone around and like with the blogs and whatnot, and after you have had people read the books in the past and then also take a preview of this one, have you had some particularly good comments that you've received from within the magic community or outside?
Well, yeah. What's interesting is the publisher would say to me on more than one occasion, Can you get a magician to say something nice about the book? And I would say, who's a magician? Who do you know? You're not a magician. Tell me as a layperson. And, Penn and Teller. No, I can't get Penn and Teller. David Blaine. No, I can't get. How about Chris Angel? Please, no, I don't think so. And I said, the average person knows three magicians, or David Copperfield, maybe. Mm-hmm. That's where, maybe. And the average, and then that's about it when it comes to complete name recognition. I said, but there are people that will be respected by magicians. And she said, well, okay, go ahead and try that. So I have had a little bit of an email correspondence the last couple of years with Jim Steinmeier. I met him at the Genie convention and just chatted with him briefly. And I emailed him when The Ambitious Card was coming out saying, I know you're a very busy person, but if there's any way you could look at the book and give me a blurb. And he gave me such a nice response. John, I don't really read fiction. I don't think I'd be of any value to you. Thank you so much for thinking of me. Blah, blah, blah. And so time came again for the bullet catch to, please get me a magician. And I thought, well, I will aim high again. So I emailed him back. I said, I know it's been a year. I'm sorry to keep bothering you. I'm just asking because, you're Jim Steinmeier. And he emailed back almost immediately and said, you know what? I'm going to do it. Thank you for your nice note. I'm going to do it. And he read the book and he gave me just, I'm going to read you the quote because I have the email. I still carry the email on my phone with me. He wrote, the bullet catch is a wonderful, engaging, delightful, tricky bit of mystery. Fans of magic will delight in John Gaspard's artful use of the world of magicians on stage and off stage. It's a great story and great fun. Jim Steinmeier. So I sent that to a couple of magician friends of mine who flipped out. And one of them said, so he's like the top three mind in magic, right? And I said, yeah, I think you could probably put him up there. And then I told my publisher, she said, and who's that again? And I said, well, have you heard of Aladdin on Broadway? Oh, yes, The Flying Carpet. I said, that's Jim Steinmeier. And that's how she was able to make the connection. So, for me, that's huge to get a blurb like that from someone like him who's so kind to take the time, a guy who doesn't generally read fiction, to sit down and do that, which was so kind. But to the average person, it doesn't have the same impact. So it's funny when you try to balance that. What is, they say you need to get publicity for your book. Well, who's going to be of interest to a reader? If they don't know magicians, why would they care?
True. I think you could have something after their name. You could say Joe Bo, comma, magician. And it could, to the common reader who wouldn't know more than just one name, let's say like Copperfield or whomever, that wouldn't mean anything, even with the title. It's like, okay, but they don't recognize how venerated the person is within the magic community. Certainly, I believe that Jim Steinmeier has a very unique, almost transitional, and ethereal kind of a reputation working with Broadway, you know, Beauty and the Beast and so many other things. Some people from New York and who go to plays frequently and know the people behind the scenes might know who he is. And, of course, he's written several books that have been available for the general public, you know, Hiding the Elephant.
Yeah.
And several others, you know, certainly. And, of course, well-known throughout the magic community and well-respected then as well. So I think that, you know, he has a little bit different kind of cachet, I think, with the general public, more so than you might imagine. Even though that your publisher didn't know who he is by name, I think there will be some who will know more than just with the common Joe Blow, common magician kind of a person.
But I think that's indicative of the magic community and their willingness to just be nice to someone who's asking something that's, you know, it wasn't, I'm sure, a huge deal. But I've done blurbs for books, and you got to sit down and read the whole book and come up with something, and it's time consuming, and it was just very nice of him to do that. On a similar note, I like to open the book with different quotes, and there is one from Jamie Ian Swiss that I'd read or heard somewhere. I made a note of it. I didn't know where it came from, but I know that he'd said it. And I emailed him and said, I got no money for you, but I would love to use this quote for you to open the book, and I'll tribute it to you and send you a copy of the book. And he's so sweet. He said, absolutely. Whatever you need, go right ahead. So, and the quote that he gave, which I thought was so perfect for this and many other mysteries, is nothing is foolproof because fools can be very determined.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
That is very good then, too. Well, you mentioned Penn and Teller. I want to go back to them. You were saying mm-hmm. some people that you felt like you wouldn't be able to contact. I would think they are certainly the most well-known
yeah.
magicians, again, outside the magic community. Even though that they have a show in Las Vegas, there are several mm-hmm. television shows.
Oh, yeah. They're all over the place.
Yeah, all over the place. And so I know that they are being contacted on a regular basis about all kinds of things and trying to say, would you endorse my product, this or that. But I think by having the clever title of The Bullet Catch, that might intrigue Teller in particular, I think, to have perhaps have responded.
Well, you know, I contacted their management mm. and did it as professionally as possible. And, yeah. and the response was, thank you. They are really just too busy. And, mm. and they are. I mean, if you look,
sure.
you know, I think he just did that, the new play of The Tempest. They've got the TV show. The one from Britain is a year old. Mm. They got the show. I mean, they're very busy people, and it's a lot to ask to sit down and read a book and write a blurb.
Right.
So, yep. but if, you know, I follow them both on Twitter, and I mention the book from time to time, and maybe they would look at it. I think they would both enjoy it if they like fiction. Have you seen the Penn and Teller Fool Us TV series?
I have, certainly. Yeah, you know, first of all, I was very familiar with that because of friends in England who were always telling me, you know, hey, I'm going to be on, and then they would post the YouTube video or whatever. So whenever it was finally brought over to the U.S. and rebroadcast here, they were the same shows, obviously, over there, just mm-hmm. formatted for our commercial network
right.
over here. And many of those things and people I had already seen and were aware of. Like Matthew Beesh and John Archer and some
yeah.
of them, you know, that yep. it was kind of cool seeing them. So, yes, I'm familiar with the show.
Well, it was so much fun to watch them react to magic and to see their genuine delight in either being mystified or when they weren't, their delight at the skill that they were observing. And I think at one point someone had done something and Teller's, Penn said to the audience, You people don't understand. This isn't something that takes a month or a year or 5 years to learn. This takes 10, 20, 30 years to get this good. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really fun to see that after, I don't know how long they've been together, 30, 35 years, whatever, that they still have a genuine love of performers and of good magic.
And I appreciate how respectful that they are of that.
Oh,
just with
yes.
that with that story you just related right there, certainly, because some people think, you know, they don't care, they expose magic, and, you know, whenever I first saw them, they were playing on the L.A. stage, just a few blocks away from the Magic Castle, and I was out there working the castle that time in the 80s, and I remember Bill Larson had dubbed them the Bad Boys of Magic at the time. And, you know, that's whenever they initially were using the cups and balls with plastic see-through cups and aluminum balls they wadded up. So
there was a moment in the series where there was a young boy who's maybe 13, 14 years old, and he did a great job. He might have even fooled them. I don't remember. And Penn said, you need to understand this. You are us at age 14. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine that level of encouragement being given to someone starting out, being told that, you know, you have the potential to be that good. I mean, I'm just floored by their generosity in that regard.
And their sensitivity.
It's just,
Well, there's no question, you know, that they both love magic. If you compare that, let's say, like with Siegfried and Roy, that Siegfried seemed to be the one who was always interested in magic, and Roy was the one who was interested in animals. They both together, of course, were interested in the magic community in general. But in this case, you know, Teller really is really more the magician, and Penn more the juggler. But both have a passion for magic, certainly, and Penn's has grown over the years, I believe. And so, they're almost indistinguishable from each other as to their creativity and their love and passion for magic.
And it was really fun to watch them get fooled by stuff that you would have thought they should know. I mean, I didn't know I was dumb, but I thought, well, they should know. That seemed like something they should know.
But that's another thing. I assume you've seen Wizard Wars.
Yeah, I'm not as delighted with Wizard Wars, but.
Okay, well, when you're looking at their reactions sometimes, some of the things in which they've been fooled, you know, they just kind of look at each other and just kind of shrug, I don't know, that was really good.
That was really good. Have you been watching The Carbonaro Effect?
I have, yes. That's
another terrific show. Just, he's so charming I don't know, it's just so clever. There's just a lot of good magic on TV right now.
Well, I think that's what's important is you have to have a good personality, I believe, in order to sell magic, particularly to the masses through the television screen. If you're on stage and you're doing close-up at a restaurant, that's one thing. But to actually go through the TV set and to break that, what I'd almost call a fifth wall. Usually there's a fourth wall from the stage that you break, but in this case, you're having to break a fifth one through the glass, you know, or the LED screen or whatever to the audience, certainly out there. And that has to be a very difficult thing. And someone like Carbonaro, really has an engaging personality. And likewise, I think on Wizard Wars, some of the guys and gals who have been on there, who have won, have just engaging personalities. Like, I could watch more of that person.
Yep. Yeah. That's what makes the show work. But the whole competition element of it, I'm less interested in. But you do get to see some really clever.
Yeah. There are some things on the Masters of Magic, the show that is broadcast, actually broken up into little chunks so that you might see this guy this week and then 2 weeks later the same guy, but a different, kind of a thing. That seems kind of stilted to me. I mean, certainly it's good magic and it's good for magic and magicians in general for people to see magic, but it, to me, just seems a little, as I said, kind of stilted and cardboard, I guess. Yeah. I don't see I think the reason there again is you don't have enough time to spend with an individual person. They do like a quick trick, and within 3 minutes they're on to the next person. And that's why a while back when Michael Finney was on, he seemed to get more showtime to develop his character and do something. And I read some comments on Facebook and elsewhere in which they said he really came across. Well, that was the reason is I believe all those others could also, if they were given more time, rather than breaking them up into chunks and it's just kind of a flash of this and that and whatever. It's kind of a collage of magicians, basically, and it all becomes an amorphous mystery of some sort. And it's okay, but it's more filling than enjoyable.
Yeah, it could be any one of them doing whatever they just did. They're interchangeable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, as far as Eli Marks goes, he seems to have – you really haven't talked too much about – him being in a performing situation, you know, in the books, so far. I mean, it's been where he's preparing for a show, or he's just going or coming from a show, or like in the first case where he was on a television show being interviewed or whatever, that there hasn't, I guess there was in the second one, I think.
He does in the Bullet Catch, he does a couple impromptu things. He does one at his high school reunion, which, gets his old flame interested. And then he is hired to go do a house party. He walk around at a house party and finds out that there's only one guest at the party. It's this creepy old house with this creepy old man. And he is.
We've all done that.
Yeah. And he isn't really there to do magic. He's there because the guy wants information. But because he's an odd old man, he does require that he do a trick, which is when he does the invisible deck. And in the third book, imagine if you were a decent magician and your girlfriend saw Tommy Wonder and was a little bit awed by him. And what would you do as just a standard magician if all of a sudden you have to compete with Tommy Wonder, who's charming and funny and who puts so much effort into his act? And that's what happens in the third book, is Eli realizes he's been sort of coasting and he has not done the work he needs to do on his act. He's been doing, I think at one point he says in one of the books, I'm still telling jokes that I wrote when I was 15. He has not really updated his act and done the kind of work he needs. And that's, you know, the second book is about his fear of heights and his panic attacks and trying to keep people alive. The third book is all about jealousy and what do you do when you're not really doing the kind of work you need to be a good magician.
Very good point. I see what you're saying is that it, I was just thinking for a moment, like the seven deadly sins, you know, where we talk about jealousy, you know, and also death and different things that he's going to be going through. But the fact that we all have some things in our act that we've been doing for years and years and years, and I think that the older that magicians get and the longer they've been doing an act, it becomes less fresh. And that becomes the real challenge, to make sure that it is going to be as fresh as the first time that you had presented it, but you have the experience and timing that you've learned from 35 years of experience.
Exactly.
And so that's true, that you know, for an example, a joke that you wrote in high school maybe is still funny. You know, I can see that in my act. There are several things that I've been doing for 20 plus years. And I do that because that they are classics, and they're classics for a reason. You know, Bill and Lemon, things like that. It's just my presentation and over the year of honing it down to where you have the right lines and moves and everything, you know, that's going to work for certain things. But I think also that you have to kind of work in some new material, you know, from time to time. So I think that
it's not like you need to do the Louis C.K. thing where, you know, he throws his act away every year and builds a new act, builds a brand new 90-minute show every year. That's not what Eli's being told, but he is understanding that that he has been coasting, and that just because something works doesn't mean that it can't work better, and just because he's comfortable with something doesn't mean there isn't a better way to entertain the audience. And I think that's a fun thing for magicians to look at, because we all get in these ruts,
right?
And there are certain times that we just have to learn to just let it go.
When you look at things that magicians lecture on, or they've written a book about, no sooner does the book come out or the lecture notes have been published, whenever they go out on tour to lecture about what's in their book or notes, they'll say, now here is a little variation that's not in the book because I have found here are some other things. In other words, that you're always working, you're always tweaking, you're finding something new or a different way to present it, a different line, you know, whatever, or along the way that someone has seen something that they have offered to help, quote, improve your act. And so I think those are very important aspects as well.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm not a performer, I'm not a magician, but I do know that the magicians I know, there's stuff that they've been doing for a long time, and we've even talked about, you know, at what point do you go, I've got to retire that. It's too much of a crutch. I need to do something new and fresh. If you're doing a torn and restored newspaper and all you're thinking about is where you're going to go for dinner, because you don't need to think anymore, maybe it's time to look at something new in that slot.
That's true. Well, that's where I was talking earlier about saying that you need to keep that fresh. Reminds me, there was a magician in New York City who died a few years ago, Brents. My mind went blank. I can't think of a black magician. Great guy, did Duck Productions. And I saw some video of his early act that were, first of all, some photos, and then it went to some video, and it showed him doing the act then, and then like 30, 40, 50 years later, almost step for step as he was walking across the stage. I mean, he would take the same number of steps to go and produce a duck over here and produce something over here. And it was still a great and a solid act that obviously, you know, took him a lot of places and was very successful and made a professional career for him. So he was able to keep that act fresh. And I think that you've got a good point there too, John. If a magician feels as if that you're just mailing it in, then it's time to challenge yourself.
Yep. I mean, but who am I to talk? I'm not.
You're just an author, just an author.
Just an author, just barely an author.
Yeah. And so, with this last book of the Ambitious Card that you sold a lot, are there numbers that you can share, or have you got any kind of an idea about?
You know, I don't think I'm allowed to, but okay. I know that they were happy enough with it that
they're ready to do another.
When I said the second one was ready, they put it on the schedules out.
Fair enough.
Reading it, mm-hmm. And I've told them where I stand on the third book, and they're very excited about that. And I got very lucky, Scott, because like I said, when I wrote the Ambitious Card, I had it for a couple of years all done and polished, and I went through two different agents who, each of them were really, really good agents, and they sent it to all the right people and all the right publishing companies. Nobody wanted it, which is very common in what would be considered for that a first novel, in a kind of a weird, they don't often have male leads in this sort of book because it's considered a cozy, which is not, you know, it's not a thriller. It's not particularly violent. It's mostly just a fun mystery with a sense of humor. After the agent said, you know, they can't do anything with it, by chance, I read a review of a mystery that sounded nothing like my book, but it had a good sense of humor to it. And I didn't recognize the name of the publisher, and I looked online, and they had a dozen books or so. And I sent them the book, and they called me like 2 days later and said, your book happened to come to the top of the pile. We don't know why. It should really be months before you hear from us, but we read it, and we love it. And I got very lucky with a company that was just starting out with a dozen books, and now they probably have 30-some books and probably 12 authors that they work with. It was just, I don't want to say pure luck. I mean, I had a finished book, but I got lucky with the publisher. and I know that that's a very common story, that people have finished a book and they try to get it out. I know the book Ordinary People, which was written, became the movie Ordinary People, was written by a local author in Minneapolis. I believe that she had over 100 rejections from publishers before anybody bought it. So I recognize that I got very lucky. I happened to find the right publisher at the right time, who got excited about this book and luckily got to write another one in an honorary to the third.
There was something that you alluded to there about a local author, and mm-hmm. that has to do with movies. Is that something that perhaps is on your radar or bucket list or something that you would like to do a screenplay for one of the
books? I would love for someone to want to do like a cable TV movie like once a year. Like there's a series I think called The Librarian that Noah Wiley, the actor, does, or like the TV show Dexter, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But not weekly. I think once a year a mystery with this character. I think he's the right age for an actor Neil Patrick Harris, mm-hmm. who would be wonderful in the part and who would do the magic. That would be great, but that being said, that the books are the books, and that's what I wrote, and that's what I want people to enjoy. If something else happens with it, that'd be great. I don't think I'd really want to be involved other than saying, thanks, you know, I'd be happy to give advice, but it would be very hard to sit down and write one of these as a screenplay after having written the book, because it's a whole different mindset.
I know it is. You know, I just finished the book Gone Girl by Gillian. What's her name?
Gillian Flynn?
Yes, Flynn. And then saw the movie and noticed in the credits that she was credited with writing the screenplay by herself also. I mean, it had her name as the author and then next it's screenplay by Gillian Flynn. So I thought that interesting because typically they have one or the other one, or that in the screenplay that the author may be credited along with whoever else had done it. Because I understand those both are just two completely different styles of writing.
They are, and I think in that particular instance, because it was directed by David Fincher, mm-hmm. I think he has a very strong hand on how the scripts are done. Mm-hmm. So it probably was easier for her to do that just because there was someone who really knew what he wanted out of that book. Mm-hmm. And if you had a director who wasn't quite sure what they wanted, it would be a lot harder to do.
Yeah. Well, that sounds fantastic. And as far as the book goes, that's going to be released when?
Well, the official release date is Tuesday, November 4th. It's coming up. And if anybody is listening and is in the Twin Cities area, we're having a release party the next day, which is Wednesday, November 5th. It'll be at Once Upon a Crime Bookstore, which is right near the corner of 26th and Lindale in South Minneapolis. Starts at 7 o'clock, and the real reason to come is that the magician Suzanne, who to know and who lives around here, will be performing close-up magic for the first hour. And Suzanne won Close-Up Magician of the Year from the AMA last year, was it? The year before last. And she's a terrific magician, terrific close-up magician, and also was the person who taught me how to do an ambitious card routine.
Yeah, we've got her book next year for the IBM convention in Jacksonville, as well as part of the talent.
You know, she is just delightful.
She is.
And her years of working in restaurants really pays off when it comes to interacting with people and with getting ahead of anything they might be doing. She has a new DVD set that just came out of her Magic Castle act, which was really fun to watch because you get to see her thinking behind the different effects. And then what I love this when magicians do this, when there are certain parts of the act, and there are not a lot of them, but there's some things where I should say, and this particular portion is so-and-so's handling of this. And then she won't show you how it's done because it's not hers.
Right, it's not hers to give.
It's not hers to give. And so she does everything up to her part, and then just, you know, she gives the acknowledgement of whose this is. So if you want to go track it down, you can do that, and continues. And I that history of providing the documentation of where this trick came from. In fact, Scott, you actually helped me in the bullet catch because and I'm going to forget the name of the trick, but there's a point in the book where Eli has to do a trick very quickly with some beat up cards. And
set the cards across?
No. Boy, if I were a brighter person, I remembered. But anyway, I just sent you that section and said, is he describing this properly? And you said, yeah, he's doing, and then you listed for me, he's doing this, but it's actually so-and-so's variation on this, which is actually this guy's thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I took your email and just did a couple minor edits to it, and I dropped it in. That's what Eli says now as he's talking to the guy. He says, well, I'm doing such and such, but this is actually a variation on so-and-so's, which he published as such and such. And then he at the time in the story, he's in a very threatening situation and he's kind of terrified for his life and sort of reprimands himself silently, like, why are you bothering to do that, to give these acknowledgments right now to this guy because this guy doesn't care? But I just love that about magicians, is that sense of the history and the sense of, you know, this is the guy who created it and this is the variation on it and this is a version of this. And I just think that's so respectful of the people who come before you.
Well, I think it was something by Winston Churchill who had said something about only by looking backward can we see into the future.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that we always say we stand on the shoulders of giants, and we have to recognize that we are just building upon what has already been out there and recognizing them for what that is. Well, as far as where these are going to be available, certainly if they're going to be in the Twin City area there in November, that they can pick that up. But if they also just want to order that online,
It's available now not available now. You can pre-order on Amazon. I'm pretty sure that the Barnes & Noble does the same thing. If you go to either one of those sites and look up the Bullet Catch, I'm one of the few things you're going to see there. So that's kind of nice. Or if you want to go right to the website for the publisher, it's called Henery Press, H-E-N-E-R-Y. Or you can do that. And if I did find out, I paged through Scott, and let me just read to you what he says. Let me see. Again, this is a variation on a very popular trick in magic circles. It's called Dr. Daly's Last Card Trick. Actually, this is closer to Eddie Fechter's version, which he called The Honest. What is it? I continue getting caught up in a mental spiral of accreditation, which is in itself very similar to David Williamson's The Memory Test, although I've made some adjustments of my own, which is almost exactly what you wrote to me, and I just changed some of them. But I just thought it was so funny that I asked that question, and it went down to this spiral of three different people who had an impact on that trick, which is why you're thanked in the acknowledgments.
Wow.
Because you were very helpful on that. And in other parts of the book. It's really nice that you and a couple other magicians who don't live around here, who I don't, you and I have never met in person, but we've talked a lot. They've been, you and a guy named Tom Vicinity, and a couple other folks have been willing to look at the book and help me make sure I'm not making mistakes that magicians, that would pull a magician out of the book if he or she's reading it, where they go, oh, that's wrong. I really don't want that. And you guys have been very helpful in making me seem much more like a magician than I actually am.
Well, you're welcome. So glad to have any small part that I can in there to help this and in any other future endeavor, because this is an exciting series that you are embarking upon, and I'm glad to ride in the caboose somewhere along the train at least.
I really appreciate it. It's been very encouraging and also just fun. And as I mentioned, I think on the last one, I do feel like I know you just from this podcast and from Dodd's podcast. You've been very helpful, even when you didn't know you were being helpful.
Hi, you're welcome, mate. Thank you. I don't know how to handle flattery, but I appreciate that. And I thank you also for your time here today and talking about the next book and The Bullet Catch and some of the history and how this all began. So, yeah, just a little bit of additional information more than what you had shared there in the last. And so I encourage people to go back and listen to the other interview that we did with John. Just do a search on themagicwordpodcast.com, and there's a little box there that you can type in John Gaspard in the search engine, and it will pop up the last podcast we did, and you can go back and listen to that, and I encourage you to do that. But more importantly, I encourage you to go out and buy a book, buy a copy. You know, I think it's important that that we encourage these kinds of authors, so this way they can continue to delight us, you know, with these ideas. It's not necessarily just always the books where we're learning a new trick, but also just kind of opening our imaginations with this fictional writing. I'm just enamored with it. I thought you do just a wonderful job and a good service for the magic community, and I should say just the general detective genre reading, you know, public in general, I guess.
Well, I hope if nothing else, I'm giving people who don't know magicians a sense of what's involved, and also a reason to want to go and see a magician when they get a chance. And I just want to rant for 1 second. I don't know if you've seen the movie Now You See Me.
I have.
Drove me crazy.
Me too.
That Morgan Freeman was this character who debunks magicians. And I told my wife, she said, what are they talking? There's no such thing as someone who debunks magicians. And I said, that's the problem. It's a huge hit movie. And they're going to make a sequel. And yet the premise itself is flawed. It makes no sense. There's no such person as that ever in the universe who debunks magicians. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
And that's what drives me crazy. People don't understand the reality of what it is to be a magician.
I didn't care much for the movie on so many different levels.
Yeah.
And I felt like that they kind of had an idea in mind, and then it's like, okay, in the middle that you can do whatever you want. So we need to put a car chase in here. So let's get out and start running around crashing things. Yeah. And then we'll come back and eventually it'll kind of come back towards the end. But the point is, I felt like that it was a very jumbled movie. But regardless of whatever that I thought, the public turned out in droves. It was, I don't know however many hundreds of millions of dollars that it made, but it was very successful financially, which means, of course, as you said, that there will be a sequel to that. So
maybe it'll be better.
Yeah. You know, I thought between that and Burt Wonderstone that the latter was the better of the two. And that's not saying necessarily a whole lot. I think that was enjoyable because I went there with the idea, this is going to entertain me. It's going to be funny. I like Jim Carrey. I like Steve Buscemi. I like Steve Carell. These are going to be some guys that will make me laugh. And so they did. I went there with that intention. Whereas Now You See Me, oh boy, you know, just came away very disappointed, poorly written. But anyhow,
it would be nice to see a movie that does a better job portraying the reality of being a magician, because it is entertaining.
It is. And I think that, again, if one of your books was made into some sort of a series, like you said, Dexter, or something that would be on a regular weekly basis, I believe people could then more appreciate the mind of a magician, the thinking and the work that goes into it. And then having to live a life, because there are other things that are happening in a magician's life. I mean, just like anybody else's life. I don't care if you're, you know, working in a Dairy Queen someplace. You know, I mean, that everybody's got a personal life of other things you're doing, certainly, outside of whatever it's your regular day job is. And a day job for a magician is really a night job. It's night and day, because during the day you're promoting yourself and trying to find the opportunities to work, and during the evenings and weekends or whenever that you're actually out there working, you know, for those people whose shows you've booked. But I'm kind of
it's a fascinating life.
It really is. It's fascinating and fast-paced. So, John Gaspard, I appreciate your time here again in talking about this, and I wish you nothing but just the greatest of success with this book.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
That was a greyhound yawning. I think I bored the greyhound here.
Is that right? Well, some while ago, it sounded like you had chains. I thought you were working with some sort of handcuffs or something.
Just walked by and just did a tremendous yawn. Are you done listening to the sound of your own voice, human? Could you take me out?
Oh, I hear that now. So that's a chain from the dog. I thought, again, you were kind of rattling some handcuffs or something. I've got it. What's your dog's name, by the way?
This one, we have two retired greyhounds, and this one is named Jack. And he was born in Ireland and brought here. And he has that Irish tendency to just chat and chat. Oh, there he goes. And chat, chat, and chat. Okay. He'll just talk and talk and talk. I don't know what he's talking about.
There he goes.
All right. Well, I'm sure this is really interesting for people.
Thank you, John, very much for talking again about The Bullet Catch, and good luck with that. And again, one last time, where people can go to purchase the book, again, Amazon.com, and they can pre-order it out, or...
probably your best bet. They can pre-order it, and they'll be sent out November 4th.
That's great. And for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Hey there, podcast fans. Scotty here. Thanks for listening to another podcast from The Magic Word. If you are hearing this episode through a subscription to The Magic Word, iTunes, or through a podcatcher, I encourage you to visit the website at themagicwordpodcast.com. There you will find additional content like links, photos, videos, and more. Your financial support helps encourage me to continue this effort. You can donate through PayPal by sending your generous donations to scottwellsmagic@gmail.com. Or you can buy anything in the shop on the website. It all goes to offset the costs of producing these podcasts. If you cannot donate or buy anything from the shop, then you can give me the gift of time by leaving a 5-star comment in the iTunes store for the Magic Word Podcast. That would really help. You can help spread the Magic Word by sharing links on our Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at Magic Word Pod and on Instagram at Scott Wells Magic. The guests and content on these podcasts are largely from my contacts and friendships with magicians over the years from all around the world. But if you have an idea for an upcoming podcast, or feel there is someone or some issue that I can address, then please let me know. No place is too far, as I can always use Skype to reach nearly anyone. I would love to hear from you, so please contact me at scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. I look forward to hearing from you soon. Until next time, keep on spreading the magic word. Scotty out.